voltage transmission line power systems for across the United States. Now, that's a very well-shielded system. Three wires in a triangle pattern with 120-degree phase determined between them. It's almost as good as a piece of coax cable as far as shielding is concerned. Very little of the RF energy on those wires goes to the outside world. Whereas the three wires in line are not going to be as well shielded. It's a little bit closer to being microstrip as opposed to strip line, so to speak. Strip line is where you've got an upper ground plane, lower ground plane, and a strip of material of a particular width in between, halfway between the two, and you adjust that width and spacing so that you get the impedance you like. That's strip line, very well shielded structure. Whereas microstrip is where you've got one flat plane ground and a strip of material above it separated by an insulator. And microstrip is a good transmission line, not an excellent transmission line. It tends to radiate, particularly as you go to the higher frequencies and longer lengths. So this material is a little bit more microstrip-like as opposed to strip line-like, if you know what I mean, on shielding. And at 50 megacycles, this system is going to radiate some signal. If you use 100 feet of this at 50 megs, I'm going to make a guess that 10% of your signal is going to be radiated from that transmission line. Not bad, but still interesting material. From what you see in that photograph, what would your guess, John? Is the wire something like 14 gauge? Over to you, John, K2RAW.
GG2WGV. It's 16 gauge wire, and I thought maybe the two outer ones are the 600 ohm, and the center one might be for sending a voltage up for a pulsing coil or something like that and then return through a ground structure. I thought maybe that's a current carrying wire, but I don't know. Anybody's guess is as good as anybody else's. It's well built. The plastic, they look like it's a black plastic that's been painted on the edges for some reason, olive drab, but the rest of the center is black. The wire is olive drab, so that's why I thought it was military. But no idea what the use is, Dick. Back to you, sir. And that's it from the mailbag for this week.
And by the way, 500 feet of that. Wow. That implies that somebody was running a pretty long length of it. And out at McKay Radio in Hog, Long Island, there were transmission lines like that. Also out at Radio Central, the RCA site out in Rocky Point, had a number of open wire transmission systems that were being fed with high numbers of kilowatts of energy to do radio communication across the Atlantic Ocean for press wireless, among other things, 20, 30, 40 years ago. I can remember traveling the Long Island Expressway in the late 60s, where when you passed by any of these stations, the AM radio in your automobile went crazy because they were transmitting 10 and 20 kilowatts of power into these antenna systems aimed at Europe, for instance. Okay, I think you're saying that was the end of the mailbag for this week. Is that true, John? Over to you, K2RAW.
Yeah, that's correct, Dick. You know, another quick thought. Maybe this stuff was strung up horizontally and nipped for three different antenna lengths for long wires or something like that. I guess it could be used anyway.
Yeah, to make fan dipoles out of this stuff would be very interesting. In other words, you take a length of it, say for instance 80 meters, you would chop off roughly 132 feet of this. Then when it comes to the fan dipole you're constructing out of it, the 40-meter dipole would be the middle wire. The upper wire is 80 meters. You'd cut the 40-meter wire in the vicinity of 67 feet long, but because of the capacitive coupling to the 80-meter, you'd end up cutting it a little bit shorter to bring it back into resonance. And the 20-meter antenna, you'd start off with it something like 32 feet long and start cutting it back. So you could make an extremely high efficiency, very compact fan dipole out of that material. And so having a roll of it in your backpack, so to speak, gives you a lot of adaptability of building multi-frequency antennas in the field, designed on the spot. Once you've got your notebook where you've done some testing before you went into the field, and you found out that when you make that 80-40-20 dipole, you'll find out exactly how long to make the 40 and the 20. And the same thing, you could do the design for 40, 20, 15, and 10, and so on. So it's a fairly simple measurement. Could be done by calculation and computer modeling, but with your notebook, you know exactly how long to cut these things for a field installation fan dipole. That's another nice use of it. And 500 feet of it gives you a lot of capability to doing things like that. Very few of us amateurs really need a transmission line 500 feet long. Commercial installations, maybe. We amateurs, rarely do we have a piece of property that big. Most of us are not that rich. We're too busy talking to people rather than making money. Okay, let's see what Paul's got to say. What has NASA been doing this week, Paul? WS2N with our space report, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, WS2N. Just three items I wanted to bring up. This month, actually the middle of the month, they figure between the 16th and the 18th of April, they plan on launching a rocket from Wallops Island, and that's going to be called the Antares rocket, and that's a private company. Orbital Science is the name of that company, and their goal is eventually to use the Antares to go up to the International Space Station. It's similar to what Dragon is doing and Falcon built by SpaceX. They're going to test their rocket, and eventually they'll test the payload spacecraft, the Cygnus spacecraft that they're also building, and that will carry the supplies to the space station when they eventually get going at the end of the year. Right now, this is just a test flight of Antares. Let me drop it. Antares looks somewhat designed to the Titan rocket, the ones that launched Gemini, or you know, before Gemini, they were intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs, but the Titan rocket had these two rocket nozzles sticking out of the bottom of the rocket. That's what this looks like. Quite different than the Falcon 9, which has nine rockets sticking out. So this thing's going to fly into orbit, and they've got a dummy payload representing the Cygnus spacecraft. That goes well. At the end of this year, they'll have their first launch to the ISS, and you know, with the Cygnus on board the Antares. So that's pretty cool, launching out of Virginia. Let me drop it. Should be a nice sight, you know, I mean, down by the water. Nowhere near Florida. In fact, it's probably, what, maybe 400 miles from Long Island. It's different. We've got different spaceports that are going up to the space station. We've got Japan launching from Japan. We've got we have launches from Florida. We have launches from French Guiana, and now we're going to have launches from the state of Virginia. So. Following that one pretty closely. They completely rebuilt the spaceport down there, you know, on private money. Again, it's one step forward for the commercial space flights. Drop it. Now, they'll carry, you know, a couple thousand pounds, similar to what Dragon can carry. The difference is, Dragon's got big plans on eventually having manned crews go up to the space station in the Dragon, where this company doesn't. This is going to be a cargo-only system. They've already got, half a dozen or 10 flights planned, contract with NASA to do this. And they're also different in the respect that they will not be reusable. Dragon comes down on a parachute. In fact, it just came back a week or so ago. Stayed on board the space station for almost a month. And it came back with scientific supplies, valuable equipment that they needed. Actually came back with more weight than it went up with. It went up with a little over 1,000 pounds, and it came back with a little over 2,000 pounds. And unlike the Progress ship or the H-2 by Japan, or even the ATV, automatic transfer vehicle, by European Space Agency, those vehicles don't come back either. I mean, they load them up with garbage. We've got to get rid of a lot of garbage on the space station over months and months of use, and it just burns up all the Pacific Ocean. That's what Cygnus will eventually do, same type of thing. Let me drop it. So with that, I wanted to move on to the Soyuz spacecraft that just docked with the space station. Went up for a couple of days ago, and unlike previous flights, 34-some-odd flights by Russia going up to the space station, this one is different in the respect that the time it took. Usually you'll launch from Baikonur Space Port, Kazakhstan, out of Russia. And it takes you two days to dock with the space station. And this time it took them only 6 hours, or less than that, a little less than 6 hours to dock with the space station. Different kind of maneuvering that they're doing. They tested it with the Progress. The last three Progress spacecraft have done the same thing. They've gotten up there in six hours instead of 2 days. So it's a big advancement. You know, you've got a crew of three people that board this thing and have to sit in this tight environment aboard that spacecraft for 2 days. And now, you know, 5-6 hours later, they're at their destination. So I thought that was pretty interesting, yeah. They'll be doing that from here on in. Drop it. Remember, the Space Shuttle used to do the same thing. It used to take a couple of days before you got to the space station. Now they've cut it down to less than 6 hours. And just one more thing. They've got a comet that they're looking at now. Not the one that we talked about a month or so ago, the one that went from the 12th to the 24th of this month on the Western Horizon, which I never saw, by the way. But this one is supposed to be, they've got hopes of it being one of the brightest ones in the last 50 to 100 years. They call it ISON, and that's ISON, it's an abbreviation. So, for International Scientific Optical Comet. And it was discovered by SWIFT. SWIFT is the one that flies around with the gamma ray radiation. And it picked up this comet some 500 million miles out. Drop it. US2N, space report. ISON, I'm not sure how they pronounce it, will be very close to Mars in the very beginning of October. So with the orbiting spacecraft there, you've got a bunch of them. You've got Mars Express by the European Space Agency. You've got Mars Odyssey and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter by the United States orbiting Mars. As well as Curiosity, I think Curiosity might have a chance of taking a picture of this comet too, if it develops the way they hope it does. They'd love to see take a picture of a comet from the planet of Mars, and they think that would be very cool. And eventually we'll get near the sun, another month or two later. less than a million miles away from the sun, and eventually about 40 million miles away from Earth, December 26th. We'll look forward to looking for this comet, see if it develops. Right now it's giving off a tremendous amount of, I'm trying to figure out if this is right. The article I read, let me drop it. This is giving off over 100,000 pounds of dust per minute. Sounds like an awful lot, but I guess that could be 100,000 pounds per minute, even now, all the way out 500 million miles away. Dust, not water, not as much water. So I don't know about that, but we'll have to look into it. I mean, they gave an actual number, 112,600 pounds of dust. We'll have to see. And if that's true and continues on like that, it could be the brightest comet that we've ever seen. Or it might just fizzle out like some of the other ones have. And that's pretty much it, Dick. Any questions, whatever, we'll be here. Back to that WS2N. Space part of the TechNet.
Good stuff, Paul. 100,000 pounds per minute coming off this ISON, ISON comet. And I think you said that Swift discovered it because of its gamma ray emissions. I'm curious as to how it can emit gamma rays when it was 500 million miles away. When Curiosity landed on Mars, Mars was roughly 300 million miles away, so a little bit further than Mars and a far portion of its orbit is where this thing was discovered. And when you said it's going to come within 1 million miles of the Sun, my goodness, is that close, because the Sun has a little bit less than 1 million miles in diameter. 900,000 miles in diameter is roughly the Sun. You can come within 1 million miles of it. That's approximately one solar diameter from the Sun. Well, that thing's going to get hot. And when it comes to the 100,000 pounds per minute, is that the projected emission rate of dust coming off this comet? Or is that the current emission rate? I'm going to turn it back to you eventually for answers on that one, Paul. Huh. So, depending on how much the Sun heats this thing up, and is there a guess as to how big this comet is? And it looks to me like it's a comet that is somewhere in the vicinity of the orbit of Mars and Earth, unless it's one of these highly elliptical things like Halley, which goes way out there, very elliptical orbit. When it comes to the new spacecraft going up, Antares, by Orbital Sciences, I guess that is the second of the commercial vendors that's going to be servicing the ISS now that we've abandoned the International Space, now we've abandoned the Space Shuttle. And so the...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
From what you say, it's cargo only. And it burns up on reentry. And I guess Progress does that. You might also mention, Paul, how many pounds of cargo does Progress take? And I think Progress burns up on reentry. I don't think they recover that. Whereas Dragon and Falcon, Dragon, I think you said, took up 1,000 pounds and took back down 2,000 pounds and was recovered. Interesting. So far it's beginning to look like a moderate amount of success in the alternate launch procedures after we've abandoned the space shuttle, which did have its safety factor problems. I mean, where we've lost Columbia and having trouble remembering the name of the first one we lost with Christopher McAuliffe on board. Out of all those shuttles, roughly $2 or $2.5 billion each, and we've lost two of them and a lot of astronauts.
Challenger, Dick.
The word Challenger, so Challenger and Columbia. When you lose them twice, when it happens once, you can say to yourself, well, that was an unusual circumstance. When it happens twice, fool on on you if you think that that's not significant. Mother Nature is telling you something. And that ice falling off of that that external tank hitting the wing is really nasty stuff. And you damage that wing and you don't come back home. Well, at least you don't come back home alive, as we found out from Columbia. So, is 100,000 pounds of material now, or projected after it goes near the sun, roughly how many pounds on progress does it take up? And anything else you want to tell us, Paul? WS2N, KQ Rally, W in the TechNet. Go ahead, meet your space. Further space report.
Mission for Paul.
And let me answer my questions first, and I'll turn it over to you, John. Paul, you got it.
Okay, real good. Dealing with the comet, first of all, I just read about this not too long ago, so I tried to research a little further. Don't have much more information on it, and I do estimate a lot here on the net. For instance, I said the sun, it'll be a million miles from the sun. I give you close enough numbers, but it's really 730,000 miles, so it's actually close to that. I'll say 40 million miles from Earth. It's going to be 39 million miles from Earth, things like that. I do that all the time, by the way, I'm sure you noticed. As far as the orbit, I don't know if it's following the ecliptic or not. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. Again, not enough detail. Comets could come in from anywhere. You know, I mean, the long-duration comets coming in from the Oort cloud. Some of the ones, probably this one is ecliptic. Those tend to originate from the Kuiper belt. Oort cloud is a big sphere around the sun. Around the whole solar system, the outer part of the solar system, where the Kuiper belt is. It runs the same plane as all planets. So, it's long duration once you know, maybe they'll come every million miles, every million years might you know, they could be coming from the Oort cloud. So that's we'll have to look further into this comet story. As far as the amount of pounds coming off that, I tried to find it on another website. I just can't find it. We'll find it. We've got plenty of time to find out if that's right. Sounds like an awful lot. It's what they say.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's what they're saying is happening now. It's 112,000 pounds of dust per minute right now. And it's not even getting near the sun. So it's dust, it's very little water. Most comets are loaded with water. So if that holds true, once the dust is getting closer to the sun, it's going to have a tremendous tail coming off the comet. And the size, don't know how big, don't know the mass, very little about it. So we'll look further into it. Yeah, and Swift was the one that discovered it. I don't know. I mean, they didn't say gamma rays were coming off the comet. Just somehow I got picked up in the photograph I saw. It does look fuzzy compared to the background stars. So how Swift does that, how it gets recorded on their CDs, I don't know. But they did show a picture of it on the website I was on. And as far as the shuttles go, drop it. Hey, John Bright with the Challenger. You lost seven people on that. And then you had the other spacecraft, the other shuttles. You had Discovery, you had Atlantis, and then they lost Challenger. They said, okay, we need to replace this. So they built Endeavour. And of course, Columbia was the other one that we lost. And talking about people, we lost seven on that one too. So we never lost anybody in flight. On Mark getting close on Apollo 13, but shuttle program, 14 people. Not good. Mr. Robbins? 135 come on missions. Have two failed missions. I mean, that's... one out of 100 would be bad. The odds of climbing up there already, yeah. They had to do something. I think the manned space program that they have now, that's going to be going off up with the private corporation. Sounds like a good idea. In the long run, your costs are going to be down. And then I think they're going to follow very good safety procedures. And we'll see how it goes. Right now, I mean, if it's anything like the cargo missions that they're doing, should be pretty good. WS1, one more comment about the commercial flight. These are the first two that will be active, SpaceX and Orbital Science. Now you've got two more waiting in the wings, Sierra Nevada's. They're building the another spacecraft. That thing's like a small space shuttle. And that's planned on taking off from Wallops Island, also from the Virginia coast. And that'll be launched on a NASA Atlas V. They won't have their own booster. They're just building the, what they call the Dream Chaser. You'll be able to put up seven astronauts in there if you want. And it will go to the space station. And my guess is they'll probably put 2-3 astronauts at a time. And they'll probably load it up with cargo. We'll have to see. That will land on a runway, and any runway. I mean, if they want to land at Kennedy, they could. They don't need this 2-mile-long runway that they had for the space shuttle. And the other private company is... And maybe within a year or two, they'll have their first launch of the CST 100. 100 meaning the kilometer. They consider anything over 100 kilometers that you're in space, which is equivalent to 60 miles. Anything 60 miles and up, that's where they get their 100. And that's another capsule-style spacecraft designed to carry up to seven astronauts. And that, of course, will be able to carry cargo. Of course, we'll return to Earth with astronauts on board, and that's being developed by Boeing. So pretty much, yeah, that's got the Bigelow Corporation. They're not into building spacecraft, but he's the guy developing the next space station inflatable. So we'll see how he makes that. He's going to have a time convincing people to go up there unless it's a proven technology. Drop it. And a module up to the space station is going to inflate. They're going to leave it attached for probably a year or two and see how it does, make sure it doesn't leak. But it sounds good. I mean, he's dead serious about it. It's got two inflated spacecraft up there already. Genesis 1, Genesis 2, and smaller units than what he plans on putting up for a space station. But they've been up there for years. I mean, they're active. They're sending pictures back to this day. John had a question. Over to you, John. WS2N.
35 volts. John, you know who you are. Go ahead, KC2WGB.
KC2WGB. Dick, I was going to ask the question, what is the size? Because, I mean, how much dust could be on a rock? You know what I mean? So, all right, they know how many pounds are coming off, but they have no idea the size. Kind of strange. And I assume it's oblating, and due to solar wind, I mean, I don't think it's like loose dust laying on there getting blown off. It just sounds weird. But I thought
entering the center of the solar system for the first time in a long time, and is starting to sense solar heat and giving off 100,000 pounds of material per minute. If it did that continuously, it would have evaporated a long time ago. So I'm guessing this is not one of those asteroid-like things that continuously circulates between Mars and Earth orbits. This thing, I'm guessing, is highly elliptical. When it comes back to you, Paul, the Ison comet, I guess I don't know the timing. How soon does it pass by the sun? And by the way, you said that 730,000 miles to the sun, and the sun is 900,000 miles in diameter. So it's not even one solar solar diameter away. That is awfully close. So with that extra heating, when it gets that close, wow. And it's already issuing 100,000 pounds of stuff now, and that can go up by many times. When that launch takes place from Wallops Island, Virginia, of the Antares Orbital Sciences craft, as it goes up the East Coast, will we be able to observe it? If that's a nighttime launch, is that something that you and I can see from Long Island? I wonder if you know that. So can we see that? What was the other question? You better get better memory than I do as to what I just asked you. When it comes to the new comet, Ison comet, what's the guess as to the timing when we might get a good view of it? WS2N with the Space Report, KQRIW in the TechNet.
I would say any time, November into December. We're talking about October 1st being closest to Mars. That's where Curiosity and some of the orbiting spacecraft might be able to take a picture of it. And that would be about 6 million miles away from Mars, October 1st. And then in November, at end of November, they said the 28th, it would be closest to the sun. So, naturally, it's not going to burn up into the sun. Eventually, it starts getting further away from the sun. And December 26th will be closest to Earth, 39 million miles away from us. So, not that close. Maybe that would be as close as Venus would get to us, or Mars or something, when we get close to one another. So, gives you an idea what Venus looks like compared to a small comet. We'll be able to see a long tail if it works out. Yeah, and John, I don't have enough information. Like I said, I just started looking into this. That's why I'm questioning what I've read. Sounds like an awful lot of material. And very little of it's water. It's too far away. I think it's like 400 million miles out. Drop.
Question two, Dick.
Yeah, good. Go ahead, John. I think I answered the question.
Paul, with that close proximity to the sun, the gravitational pull is going to be unbelievable. Did they mention anything about it possibly getting torn apart, like what happened to Jupiter? I'm wondering. I mean, that's... And what's the distance to Mercury?
Yeah, you're talking about the tidal effects that happened with Shoemaker-Levy 9, the one that when it got close to Jupiter, broke up into 21 parts. Yeah, I don't know. That was a comet. So, I would imagine the forces would be strong enough there to occur. But I've read very little about it. And nobody said anything about that yet. Too often, but I did read John. So, that would be cool. Imagine that. Having like two, three, four comets coming off at once. But I haven't tidal force, it does sound like it's being formed. Dick, back to you.
Yeah, I was amazed that it's that much further ahead, November or December, when we're going to get the best view of the Ison comet. October 1st is when it gets closest to Mars, 6 million miles away. That's close. Whereas December 26th, closest to the Earth, 39 million miles, 92 million miles between Earth and Sun. That's called the astronomical unit. So it's going to get as close as 0.4 to 42% of an astronomical unit. Not very close to us. I'm guessing that the extremely bright view that they had of Halley's Comet at the beginning of the 20th century was because it was very close to us and it's good in size. Any word as to whether or not we will be able to observe, if it was a nighttime launch, of the Antares as it goes up the east coast from Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia? Do you think we might be able to observe it from Long Island? What's your guess on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW.
I would say, if it was anything like dusk or, you know, definitely nighttime, but I'm sure their early launches are going to be all daytime, the test run. So, in fact, I think that last Dragon launch, that was early in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, it was pretty dark. Falcon 9 went up last. So, you know, they get pretty nervy. And, you know, shuttles that have gone off from Florida, I remember seeing them, seeing the engines lit coming up the East Coast. They weren't going to the International Space Station. They were going on a little over 60-degree inclination. So those flights, I remember seeing a couple of those where you could see the engines cut out, you know, the MECO engines cut out. And did see a couple of those. And they were further out over the ocean. This is pretty close. I mean, if you look at the coastline of Virginia, you know, it's true, it's not going to be going 60. It's going to be going 58.6. It was 56.8. I think it's 56.86. I can never remember. I always push the last two numbers, but whatever. The high 50s inclination. I mean, it's going to be going out over the ocean. But being this close, you know, if you look at the globe, I think we would have a chance of seeing it. I haven't read that yet, but I thought about that myself. Nighttime, I would be surprised if we wouldn't be able to see it. I mean, it's probably not as, you know, it's not as big a rocket as Falcon 9. You know, you got maybe about a year from now, you're going to see the Falcon. They call it the Falcon Heavy. They used to call it Falcon 9 Heavy, but it's a three-stage rocket that SpaceX will be launching. That would be something to see. I mean, if they ever sent one of those things to us on an orderly flight, you know, on a private mission, which they have contracts for, we would definitely see the Falcon 9 Heavy, not Falcon Heavy, going up the East Coast from Florida. Back to you there.
So we're still heavily involved in space, even though we've abandoned the space station, space shuttle, and from what I can tell, Hubble is doing very well. The last repair mission, I've forgotten how long ago it was, you're going to tell me, but you and I are still disappointed that nobody has started building the remotely controlled robot rocket-like thing that's going to meet up with Hubble and either do a repair or a deorbit burn. I know that they added a fixture to the back of Hubble, making coupling onto it easier, but you and I haven't heard of any hardware, even on the drawing board, so to speak, that's going to mate with that structure. And I'm really convinced that sometime in the near future, somebody's going to do a study, come to the conclusion the best way to service the high orbit satellites out there is to build a one-way robot that goes out there and refuels them and does some repairs. And with the right kind of hand-arm-like manipulating things like Dean Kamen is creating, with the right kind of a television system, I see no reason why you can't do a repair in space somewhat like the astronauts do on a Hubble repair. So am I correct on some of those assumptions, like you know of no hardware built to mate with the fixture on the back end of Hubble at this time? WS2N, K2LAW.
I haven't read anything about that. I mean, I know they have the fixture attached, and I have no idea what rocket they would even send up. And definitely, I mean, they were planning for the last service mission. They were really thinking about some kind of robotic equipment to service the Hubble. But that all fell apart. I think they knew they were way behind in the capability of what they wanted to do. And they really were. If you remember the last service mission, which was, what, I don't know, it's got to be 4 or 5 years. I don't know. The time has gone by. Probably 4 years ago, at least, when they went up and did the, I mean, they changed out batteries, they changed out gyroscopes, they changed out the power supplies. They took 30-some-odd screws out of that one area to get to something that wasn't even service, you know, designed for service. And they changed out a lot of stuff. And that thing's got new solar panels on there and everything over the years. And to have robotic things doing this, I still think they're 10 years off, at least. The Hubble's not going to last that long. I would bet almost anything that that thing will eventually have to be deorbited. They'll send the craft up. Who knows, maybe a private company will do it. That's the way things are going. Let me drop it. If they did, I mean, you know, to service this thing, you need some kind of a platform to attach it to, which was the space shuttle. I mean, they attached it. Had guys go out there, 5, 6 different space walks, 7, 8 hours at a time sometimes, working on this thing. You had a platform. I mean, it was like a work area. You know, construction site, you have a trailer, you leave the trailer, you work on the equipment, and basically that was like it was, you know, exactly what it was like, and then they come back, and then rest of the day and go out and do it again. They'd have different crews, 4 spacewalkers, you'll have 2 at a time, and the next day you'll have 2 more go out. Do that with all robotics. I think they're a long way off there, you know. If it was 10, 20 years from now, maybe they'd have a shot, but I don't think so. They're going to deorbit that, either privately or government will have to send something up. I just hope they don't send a Russian thing up to do it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the thing that's scaring me is you told me 4 or 5 years ago is your memory of the last time we serviced Hubble. And the number one thing that you lose on Hubble, you're always losing gyros. And when you're down to, I think, about 2 gyros, you can no longer orient it and hold the position. And if you can't point the telescope and hold it to a position, you can't take pictures, per se. So, gyro failures is going to knock it off the air. Power supply failures can knock it off the air. Computer failures. The most serious of all those, the one that has a definite finite life, are those gyros. I'd like to believe they got better and better on the design of the gyros, but they seem to have a finite life no matter what you do. They run a certain number of years and they no longer are useful. And so you and I can speculate that there's not too many years of Hubble left in useful service before enough gyros fail unless there's something magic about those new gyros. Did they replace all of them? And there's something about the new gyros that's going to make them last longer? Any words on that, Paul? WS2N, KQRIW?
That's all right, they were all running. I think there's four of them. They get down to one. I remember reading it was one. After one, it's not serviced then. They're not going to service it. If that fails when they're working on it, you have a shuttle up there. This thing is. Could eventually wind up being out of control. Have to have at least 1 month work. They changed out gyros. They changed out all the batteries. I've never seen pictures of it. I mean, it's not like a car battery. It looks like about battery looks like about six car batteries, maybe bigger. And I think there's four sets of them. They fail, so they've changed them out a number of times. So, between the batteries and the gyros, not to mention the power supplies, any failed electronics, it's game over. But right now, it's still working, still doing good. This thing, the computer that runs off of it, it's only one step above a 486 machine. In fact, they ran that for 15, 20 years before they put the Pentium in there. And still doing good. So we'll see. Dick, I don't know what's going to happen with it, but I'm still betting that you're going to see this burn up over the Pacific Ocean like you saw the Mir spacecraft burn up the coast of the Pacific back in, 96 or 97.
Paul, what was the year that Hubble was originally launched? I'm guessing 95, but maybe it was earlier than that. 92? Are we going on 20 years of service? And when it's got a full complement of servos, you think it's four? I thought it was five. I know there's some redundancy required there. And when you're down to one servo, I think you can almost do nothing. I think it takes two servos to have complete RSL maneuverability. Back to you, Paul, KQLAW.
Yeah, I thought it was four or five rings of bell management. I'm going to go with five. I bet if you look it up, you're going to see five. In 1990, it went up. Shuttle took it up. And originally, it was planned to go before that. But Challenger happened. Things were really put off. Probably being built in Connecticut, Mira. That's where it was built. Probably late 70s, early 80s. I mean, they've worked on this thing forever. Probably supposed to go up in 85 or 86 or something like that, but soon after Challenger. But it did go up in 1990.
Wow. So it's in the 20... It's approaching its 23rd year. And arguably, that's the most productive piece of hardware that NASA has ever produced. The Progress ship... Roughly what payload does that carry up? And I think it burns up on reentry. So right now, the nice thing about the shuttle is it had a great big cargo bay made specifically for the size of the Hubble Space Telescope. And in theory, it could capture the Hubble Space Telescope and bring it back home, although it's not a smart thing to do. Of all these other commercial craft, I don't think any of them have anywhere near that size of cargo bay. And none of them can bring something that massive back, so it's not a chance. So, once again, Progress, roughly how many pounds of cargo does that bring up? And I think, double check with me that it gets burned up on reentry. WS2N, KQLAW.
Yeah, the progress, I think maximum 1,600 pounds or something like that, as I remember. They're all about the same except for the one built by the European Space Agency, actually built in Italy. And they sent up three of them so far. I got to send up another one called the Albert Einstein. And it's called the ATV, the Automatic Transfer Vehicle. And that carries three times that weight, so it's probably 6,000 pounds. So that's a big one. You got to look at it. Each one is a little different. Ones that have automatic docking features, where you don't need robotic arms or anything. There's only two of them. That's the Progress and the ATV. Progress by Russia, and the ATV by European Space Agency. And they both dock in the pirate port. Docking area attached to the Russian side. We have one on the, one or two on the American side. When Dragon goes up, it attaches to the American side. The node called the Harmony node. We have a docking facility there. So the American side is just really Dragon, space shuttle. And eventually, Cygnus dropping. At the space station, they have two docking ports as well. I think three now. They have the ATV attaches to that. The automatically Progress does it automatically. The other one, Dragon. H2, they call it the H2 by Japan. And, you know, when they go up, and the Cygnus is going to be the same way by orbital sciences. They go close to the space station, and like within 30 feet, and then they reach out with the robotic arm. The astronauts do that, and they grab it and they birth it with the space station that way. That's how they dock it. And what's cool about these things, you know, when you open them up, it's like having another room for a while when they are up there. Like ATVs always stay for 6 months, and they're relatively large, so it's actually having another room for, you know, for a half a year. Same with the other ones, the Dragon, the rest of them. As far as landing goes, we drop them. Once return, Dragon and the Soyuz spacecraft, because they bring crew down and they bring material and science stuff back, but not that much. Dragon brings quite a bit back. You know, when you think about it, it's like the weight of a small car, all the science equipment. You know, I can't imagine how much stuff they put in this thing and what's up there, but they brought it all back. That's a lot of weight. And they're the only two that have parachutes, and they, you know, naturally Dragon lands in the water. Eventually it's going to land on land. Soyuz lands on the desert in Kazakhstan. But the other ones, the ATV, the H2 by Japan, and the Progress, will burn up over the Pacific Ocean. Back to you, WS2.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is that where you said that Soyuz now goes up in 6 hours and docks with the ISS as opposed to 2 days. 6 hours is a quarter of a day instead of 2 days. That's an 8-to-1 time saving. Wow. And I've got a guess as to what's going on here, Paul. In the past, where you had limited accuracy of your navigation on board, did launch in what you think is the right orbital plane, but after you get into parking orbit, you have to make corrections of the orbital plane. You have to make a co-elliptic correction. In other words, you want the apogee and perigee to be in the right place and the right magnitudes. So altitude of orbit, tilt of orbit, ellipticity. got to match all those things. So in the past, with limited navigation capability during the launch, you got close to all those things, you got into parking orbit, and then you trimmed all of those parameters. I am guessing now that, let me drop, by way of really good inertial navigation, by way of global positioning, satellite position, location, and whatever, by these navigation techniques being much higher in accuracy, you now go straight to the target as opposed to slowly getting into the neighborhood and then finding the town, finding the right street, and then finding the right house. That's what they used to do. Now you just blast and land your parachute, so to speak, right on the correct house if you got really good navigation. That's what I think is going on. And they said words along those lines to explain how they made an 8-to-1 improvement in the docking time. WS2N, K2RIW.
I have not found that. I looked for it. I know a reason why. You know, first of all, you save on fuel. Most important thing, the manned flight especially, keep these people cooped up in a small spacecraft for 2 days. You know, it's a long time. But, I mean, they're used to it. They've been doing it for years. So, they've done it with not only with International Space Station since 2000. They've been doing it with Mir for 15 years. Before that, they had the Salyut 7, Salyut 6 spacecraft. Even when we went up to Skylab, you know, we used to take a couple of days to get up there. So, you know, they're all used to it, the Americans, Russians, and now all the other foreign astronauts that are involved. It does take that 2 days now to cut that back. I mean, I think of it like this. You know, it's usually 32 orbits before you dock. 32 orbits. You know, that's a lot of sunsets. Sunrise. Here, 4. You're there. That's great. But I don't know exactly how they're going about doing it. I don't know how much fuel they're saving. I don't know how risky it is. I know they thought about it quite a bit because they practiced the last 3 private, you know, and cargo launches from Russia. Progress ships were done exactly the same way. 6 hours in there, less than 6 minutes.
At that Soyuz, when they come back down, it's a very compact craft. Is that true? I'm guessing there's very little room left over to bring home cargo, as well as I think it can come back down with 2 astronauts. Is that true?
Now with 1, I mean, they've come down with 2 in the past, but I mean, they've always come back with 3, far back as I can remember now. Maybe back in the Mir days, they might have done it for whatever reason, but yeah, they go up with 3 and come back with 3.
Oh, but very little room left over. And they always use exactly 3 on the way up and way down. They don't just take that passenger seat and use it for cargo on up or down, no pole. Is that true?
Well, I'm sure they, you know, if they planned on it, they would arrange it. They wouldn't have that extra seat there. There would be room, you know, for something. I mean, each flight that goes up has special seats designed for each astronaut. So, I mean, first thing that they do, command that comes aboard, the other two come aboard. First thing they unload is the seats, and they keep them. Whoever goes back, they're going to have their seats attached. You know, I mean, it's that type of thing. It's always 3, and there's always 2 Soyuz spacecraft docked to the space station. Now that the shuttle's gone, I mean, if you were to fly up there and take a look, the two Soyuz spacecraft.